Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club with Tim and Hummer. Hey, everybody.
That's beautiful.
This is the Product Breakfast Club. I am your fill-in host, Hummer, in Berlin.
And I am Tim, your fill-in co-host. I am also in Berlin, but we're actually not recording this in the same space. I'm looking at Amr's really beautiful apartment right now. What do you see, Amr? A beautiful empty whiteboard.
Yeah, I just see Tim and a whiteboard and a bunch of sticky notes because he's at AGN Smart, at the company where we both work. So you guys are probably wondering, where are the actual people I want to listen to? Where's Jonathan? Where's Jake? They just, they give up on you, but we just love the podcast too much to...
We're two fans, we bought
to let it die.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is basically like fan fiction for our podcast. Like, what would happen if other people took over? Cool. So I have a couple of links for us to talk about today, Tim. Mm-hmm. Actually, no, hold on. Before we do that, professional. Yeah. But I think what Jake does usually, or Jonathan, is that they tell people what the podcast is about.
Yeah.
So normally... when the actual co-hosts are on the podcast, they talk about product design, about the design, you know, space in general. How do you design products? Well, that's what they like you to think anyway, but it's mostly them just rambling about whatever they want to talk about that week. And maybe sometime, like after 30 minutes of rambling, they'll get to some product topic somewhere here or there. Mm-hmm. So that's what the podcast is about in general. And it's also like very... not professional, as you can see, like right now, just us figuring it out on the go.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's enough of an intro, don't you think?
Yeah, great. I think you did a really amazing job making people curious and excited about the podcast.
I know, right? If this is your first episode of the podcast, I'm sorry, just go try something else.
Yeah, you should actually switch off right now and listen to maybe like 5 episodes back and then come back and then compare how much smarter we sound compared to John and Jake.
Exactly.
We're already very intelligent people.
Exactly.
So this is going great so far.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we should also give people like a super tiny intro about who we are, just like two random people who took over the podcast.
Yeah.
You start.
My name is Tim. I actually have been on the podcast before, as has Amr. I'm a product designer at AGN Smart. I'm very interested in product strategy. Yeah, it's a treat being back on the podcast again. How about you, Amr?
So yeah, my name is Amr and I also work at AGN Smart. Basically, Tim and I work with Jonathan at his company, AGN Smart in Berlin. I work on the sprint team, which is what we call our design team. We run design sprints by sprint, by make time. The design sprint is a process for product design that gets you from a problem to a tested solution in 5 days, for those of you who aren't familiar with the sprint. So yeah, because Jake and Jonathan are both traveling this week, that's why Tim and I took over and recorded this episode. But don't worry, they'll be back very soon, hopefully next week. For today, you're stuck with us. And we tried to pick a couple of interesting topics to talk about. So the first one I have here is, I think Jonathan's going to like this because he always makes fun of the use of the term like empathy in design. And he thinks it's overused. And I think he's right about that. It's definitely overused. There are words that you hear in design that get used so often that they start to lose their meaning because they become an umbrella term and they don't mean anything specific anymore and they just get used in the wrong way. They become buzzwords. So one of those is definitely the word empathy and the other one is storytelling. But for today, we're not going to talk about storytelling. We're going to talk about an article that was written by Don Norman. He's famous in the design space because he co-founded the Norman Nielsen Group, or Nielsen Norman, I always get it wrong. Basically, this is one of the first companies that just focus on user experience as a thing. And Don Norman even like coined the term user experience when he was working at Apple in the 90s. And so he's talking in this article, which will be in the show notes, titled Why I Don't Believe in Empathetic Design, why he thinks that this concept of empathy doesn't really work the way that we think about it. So when most people talk about empathy in design, they mean that you should try to put yourself in the shoes of the user and try to feel what they're feeling, because understanding the user or the customer that way would help you design a product that is good for them, basically. But so Don Norman in this article goes on to say that, in his opinion, that's impossible because you can't just put yourself in the shoes of someone else. Even if you try to imagine it, you just can't do it. And especially in the cases when designers are designing software products that are going to go on to be used by hundreds of thousands or even millions of people. In Facebook's case, that's even billions. So there is no way you can actually empathize with every user that's out there. Now, before I go on like any further in the article, that's kind of the gist of it. I want to get your take, Tim, on how you feel about this whole empathy topic and what your thoughts on it are.
Yeah, it's interesting because I always had a huge problem with just this trend of saying, hey, designers need to have empathy, because I always thought like that's kind of like meaningless. It somehow always irked me because I never really knew like what does it actually mean? Literally, like what am I supposed to do with this? Like have empathy. I think especially when you're designing something, you almost can't have empathy, because I mean, to me, empathy is something that I have to another person that is, you know, like I'm talking to, or maybe I'm seeing another person having going through something and I have a feeling of empathy for them. I can feel their pain or something like that. But it's different when you are actually designing something, you're like trying to solve product challenges and you're trying to come up with a solution and an interface. I never really felt empathetic when I put a button somewhere. Like I think about it in terms of, is this usable or not? But I never really thought about it in terms of, this is how this person probably feels when they hit that button. I mean, it never really helped me, that notion. If you are saying you have empathy, does this mean that you don't need to test anymore? Because to me, empathy is really like a feeling that you have. And it's not something that is quantifiable. Whereas when I have something and I put it in front of people and then I see how they interact with it, usually I can tell if they can make use of it or if it's somehow annoying them. But it's very hard to get a feeling for that while you're doing it. I mean, maybe you have a lot of experience, so you can already tell like that's not going to work. That's probably going to annoy people. But I think that's very different from feeling empathy. So I think it's actually really great that a person as well known as Don Norman is actually saying that, because I think, I mean, he has the standing of actually, you know, raising these issues. And I think just because this talk about empathy is like seemingly such a huge thing among designers, it really needs a person like Don Norman to say, you know what, actually, it doesn't really make that much sense. And maybe we should focus on something different.
Yeah, I really agree, because in my experience, I mean, I've heard this term a lot when in my career in design and when studying design and all of that, but I never really heard like a very specific definition of it. And I just always took it to mean that you should try to understand as much as you can about the user, and that will help you just design something that is better for them. Because if you understand what the problem is, you can obviously design a solution for it better than you could otherwise. But I never really understood the people who were so, you know, vocal about empathy, and they used it as kind of the main thing that they talk about when they're talking about how they approach design, of, oh, like empathy is so important and like I use empathy all the time. I just never really understood what people meant by that. And so I also thought that this article really put things into perspective for me. And to be fair to Don Norman, it's not like he's coming out to say that, you know, empathy is terrible. So the way he phrased it, he begins the article by saying, I approve of the spirit behind the introduction of empathy into design, but I believe the concept is impossible, and even if possible, and it's wrong. And the reason he says it's impossible is because, like I said, when you're designing for many, many people, you can't possibly try to imagine in your head what each person is feeling. And he says, instead, you should focus on the activities that people are trying to carry out. So focus on the problem, because that's much more tangible. It's something that everyone can talk about. It's not so subjective. You won't have designers saying like, oh, I think the user would be feeling this, and I think the user would be feeling that. And just having all of these discussions that you can't actually, like you can't get to a resolution at the end of the day if it's just designers talking about these things. Whereas we can agree about what the problem is or how we want to prioritize the problems that we want to solve.
Another thing he mentions in the article is that what people feel when they interact with the product is it can be wildly different. And sometimes people don't feel anything. It's not like we're this easily almost like readable machine that, you know, like you have like some inputs and then some feeling comes out of it. I mean, when I am interacting with a product like Twitter or Facebook, I don't have necessarily like an emotion, or like I have some things that I want to get out of it, but it's not like I have, you know, like these deeply subconscious things that go on and I'm feeling like, oh, I need to feel like validated. And I mean, maybe stuff like that is going on, but I mean, how do you design for something like that? Especially if some people might have completely different emotions going on as well and needs. If I'm using a product like Twitter, I'm pretty much already like I have something in mind, and I don't really know why empathy would necessarily help a designer come up with a better solution for that. I like this approach of making it, well, first of all, accessibility and usability. So on the one hand, it's about being mindful of people's unique circumstances. So for example, are they colorblind? Are they maybe of age and they can't read small text or things like that? To me, this is not the same as empathy, because for me, empathy is more of being considerate of who is actually going to use your product and how are you kind of like keeping people out of that experience. I would say that as a designer, it's in your best interest to create something that as many people as possible can use with success and with the feeling that this is actually helping me. I am not sure if empathy is really the best way of explaining like what that thought behind that is, because to me, it's more about having an awareness, but it's not the same as empathy, I would say.
Yeah, totally. And Don Norman basically summarizes this point by saying, we can get into the heads and minds of millions of people, and moreover, we don't have to. We simply have to understand what people are trying to do and then make it possible. We should not fool ourselves into thinking we can get into their heads. So I really think that like perfectly summarizes what empathy is trying to do in the first place, because like empathy is not a goal in and of itself. It's a means to an end. And I think this is the end that it's trying to go after. And then actually he goes on to really make the point by just using examples of thinking, well, like, why is it impossible? He says, there are two examples. He says, first of all, I don't understand the things that I do myself. And that's like, when I read that, it really made me chuckle, because like, that's so true. I mean, if you can't understand even your own actions and justify them, it sounds kind of preposterous that you would be able to understand what others are doing, even if you just go and have a few conversations with them. Try to understand all the complex reasons, the way people are acting and behaving and what their needs are. He says, secondly, the person I've been with the longest, 50 years at this point, is my wife. And we get along really fine, but we often don't understand each other all that well. And they laugh about how the stuff, like when she says something and he thinks he understood, and then later on he finds out she meant something completely different. So he says, like, if you look at your own life, how often can you actually claim to understand what's going on in your own head or in someone that is very, very close to you? He's lived with his wife for 50 years to be able to claim that you can do this almost on a daily basis for different types of users, for all your quote unquote personas and all of that. And that just really drives the point home for me.
I think it's a bit of hubris almost to say, hey, my design is informed by empathy. Because honestly, like Don Norman puts it really perfectly and succinctly. I mean, if you don't even understand like the person you're sharing your life with, and not even yourself, how can you claim to do that for hundreds of thousands of users? I really like this pragmatic approach of saying, you know, you can't do it and you also shouldn't have to. The way I see it is, if you're designing a desirable product, people will come to it and they will have different goals. They will have different desired outcomes, but you only need to make sure that whatever you have created facilitates what they actually want to achieve. And I mean, I think if you're looking at things like social media, it's very interesting what people do with it when you just allow them to be creative. I mean, you could say that, hey, we have a giant trolling problem, we have bots, and I'm aware that there are like huge issues. But at the same time, it's also unlocking so much creative potential that nobody could have ever planned for. And it's a really nice way of almost like as a counter argument of like the designer hubris, that they can already almost like guess what people's intentions are. And instead saying, okay, I'm just going to create this kind of like space where people can express themselves. Not everything they will do will be something that I like or that I planned for, but there will also be a lot of things that I didn't plan for that are actually great and allows these people to do something that is almost like bigger than the sum of its parts. Yeah, it's an interesting discussion for sure. I'm actually very curious what the feedback on the article was. I mean, just because I know Don Norman has a pretty big footprint. Not his actual
footprint. He's actually Bigfoot. Yeah. He's the mythical Bigfoot.
No, but in terms of attention that he gets, I mean, he's very well known. He's the author of The Design of Everyday Things. So I would just be very curious what people thought about. Have you followed up on any of the feedback that he got on that?
No, actually, I haven't. But I'd be very curious to hear what listeners of this podcast think. I mean, to make it super clear, we're not trying to antagonize people who like to use empathy and are proponents of empathy. Like, the point that I wanted to make by talking about this article is that, and agreeing with what is said in the article, is basically the spirit behind empathy is really good as an idea, but it's not a realistic goal in most cases. And by thinking that it's something that you can attain, you'll probably go down the wrong path. And you could also focus your energies in a more productive way, in a way that it actually help your customers, which is what every designer is actually trying to do in the end.
Yeah.
So yeah, this isn't about antagonizing anyone or just
I think it
telling
is,
people that they're wrong. I mean, yeah, it is. It is.
That's totally it. No, I mean, you could also argue that maybe, okay, we all agree that empathy is not really something that you will ever hit 100%, that you will ever really completely understand or apply to people you don't know. But maybe it's also just something that, like, a high bar that you set for yourself. And I mean, one thing that I definitely appreciate is if designers think about what they are working on and how it impacts people. So I think that's definitely something that is really, really useful. It's, I think, a very important mindset to have. But on the other hand, I'm not sure if it's helpful to just put empathy on your presentation deck and say it's all about empathy. Like, you need to actually tell people what that means in reality. And if you don't have an answer to that, maybe you should think about, like, what is empathy for you and how does it actually affect your design process?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think anyone should be using that term just without any context around it, especially since it has become a buzzword. If people want to use that term, they should really explain what they mean by that. Like, one, you know, it would not have become like such a big buzzword or taken on such an infamous kind of role in the design space if it wasn't helpful in some ways. Because, like, for example, I remember one company, maybe it was Facebook at one point, there was an article that came out about them trying to artificially put a limit on the internet speed of everyone working on the product in the office to simulate how it feels like for someone in India who's using Facebook on an edge connection that's like 2G or something that is super, super slow. And how that gave them like a new perspective for the importance of solving this problem and how aggressively they should go after it and so on. So you could definitely say like this is a great example of trying to apply empathy. And I would totally agree with that. Again, this could be reframed as the problem is there are people with slow connections and we should solve that problem for them. But you don't need to go to the lengths of trying to imagine that you are feeling what that person is feeling. I mean, sure, you're going to feel some like similar levels of frustrations, but trying to imagine that you know exactly what's going on in that person's head, you don't need to go to that length just to know that slow connection is a problem and you need to solve that.
I mean, to me, that's not really empathy. It's really just thinking about accessibility. And I mean, yeah, you're not really claiming to know what that person is like going through emotionally. I, for one, really love it when my internet is really slow.
Yeah.
I do love it. No, I mean, it's the same issue as designing for people with, for example, color blindness or something like that.
True.
It's good to be aware of it, for sure, because in the end, it's also a benefit for your own product. You will have more people being able to use it, and you will have more people being happy to use it because it's frictionless. to me, it's like this notion of designing something that is as frictionless as possible is a bit more important than thinking about empathy and, you know, like how somebody felt when they got off the bus that day. And I mean, it's something like, I mean, I should mention, we also used to do workshops at Agent Smart years and years ago where we would map user journeys. That was pretty interesting. Like, we experimented with things like, how does that person feel at that moment? So let's say they open their emails, they get an email from their boss, he's really angry. How do they feel? I mean, we stopped doing that because it's just completely pointless. I mean, like, yeah, of course, they are not going to feel great. Doesn't really affect the product we're trying to design. I mean, yeah, it's not like putting a smiley face onto the interface is going to save their day or anything like that. It's more about that person still has the same goal using our product, whether they're happy, whether they're sad, they just want something out of it. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like liberating to think about it in these kind of like more simplistic terms, because it's also absolving you from the responsibility of understanding human nature. I mean, nobody understands human nature. I mean, there are entire philosophies and religions based on what human nature is. And I think we will still have this discussion in thousands of years. So yeah, I don't think designers will be able to solve that question. So they shouldn't worry about it too much.
Yeah. Designers for thousands of years will be arguing about empathy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then Don Norman goes on in the article to move on to say that he's been trying to solve much bigger problems that have, you know, social impact and trying to solve for people in like disadvantaged areas of the world. And then he moves on to talk about he usually tried to use human-centered design approach, which is also like really big thing in the design space, to solve these problems. But what I found surprising is that he says, invariably, the history of success in these projects is dismally low, like just trying to use human-centered design. And the point he's making here is that basically saying expert coming in and telling people what to do is really paternalistic and doesn't work. So no matter how much empathy you try to put in, no matter how much human-centered you are in your approach to design, like we have data that shows that a lot of these projects just fail or take way longer than expected or cost way more than what the budget was. And then he goes on to say that experts can't really help on their own. And then he says local people, so let's say you're trying to solve like a problem in some third world country, and he says local people there can only solve the symptoms, not the underlying problem, because they're not taking time out of their day. It's not their job to sit down and think about what this problem is and what caused it and how to come up with a solution. So all they can do is kind of band-aid solutions on the problem. And he concludes the article by saying, I mean, he's not super clear about it in the conclusion, but you can kind of surmise that he's talking about co-creation, mm-hmm. and that if you really want to solve a problem, you need to work with the people, yeah. and be more of a facilitator, which is kind of funny because of the way that we yeah. like do things with sprints.
Yeah.
He says like, yeah. your role is just to facilitate the people's experiences, because they're going to be able to solve that problem in a way that is sustainable for them rather than having this top-down yeah. approach.
Yeah.
And if you do it that way, then you have a much higher likelihood of success.
I think it's funny that he's talking about this being, you know, like working in, you know, third world countries and local communities, because to me, this also applies to giant corporations in industrial nations. I mean, it's the same issue, right? You have people, they have challenges and they know the symptoms, but they don't necessarily know how to solve the underlying problems, because often these problems are very, very complicated to solve. You know, they might not even be aware of like the scope of the problem. And this is not just something that happens to communities in third world countries, it's happening everywhere. It's happening in our own lives. It's happening if you go to like the city administration of Berlin, I'm sure that you will have the same problem. And I really like this approach of almost like having this, yeah, I just like this idea of co-creation, because when I look at some of our clients, what they describe as, you know, like their experience working with like really big consultancies where 20 people kind of like descend to from their mountain to their corporation, work in some meeting rooms, have tons of meetings and talk about like problems. And like they leave a really interesting PowerPoint or presentation and nobody ever looks at it again. And I think the way we work is so different. I mean, this sounds like a sales pitch now. I'm really sorry. but it is very
different. Buy sprint, buy make time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is very different when you are actually working with the people and you're more like you're almost like taking a step back instead of prescribing what they should do. It's more like you're guiding them to come to conclusions themselves. And you're also adding an impartial perspective. And I think that's really powerful because, I think one of the biggest problems when you're working to solve a problem is that when you are invested in the problem yourself, it's sometimes really hard to come up with solutions because there's almost like this underlying politics of it. You know, like it's not just about the solution. You also have to kind of like encourage people to try out different things. And I think that's easier when you are not perceived as a person who might benefit from it yourself. So if you're an outsider, this is actually where being an outsider is really helpful because you're saying, look, I don't have a stake in this at all. I really just want to see you guys succeed. So let's work together. I'm sure that everyone here has really great ideas and then we will kind of like come up with something. I totally agree that just being an expert does not mean that you will have the perfect answer to anything, because in the end, you can come up with the best solution or the nicest system or whatever, or the coolest process. If people don't accept it, it's not going to work, right? I mean, they actually have to feel a sense of ownership in it as well.
Exactly. And I mean, I'm glad you brought up this point because while reading this article, I did think of this, but I forgot to bring it up now. That yes, this totally is not just limited to solving problems in cultures that are very different than yours. It also works in big corporations with companies that you work with every day and people that are similar to you. But it's just that idea of co-creation when the people that you're trying to solve the problem for are also working with you on the solution. They will feel so much more ownership, and that's like the key word here, over that solution, that after the project is done, they will take the results and evangelize them inside the company and push for them because they really feel like this is their solution. This is their idea. It's not something that some outsider consultancy gave them and told them to go do. This is actually their idea. And all the facilitator did was help them just organize, you know, how the solution process took place. So yeah, I totally agree with that.
That's actually my favorite part of the job, working with clients, that you kind of like liberate them to come up with solutions and you're just trying to create a space where they can bring up solutions without, you know, like without being anxious, without feeling like they're being judged or something like that. So if you can do that, I think you're actually doing a greater service to your client than kind of like coming up with the brilliant solution on your own and in separation from them.
Exactly, yeah. And by the way, like just as a closing note on this topic before we move on, I actually think this is somehow reminds me of the use of personas in design because they also touch on a similar concept. And personas were something that I was never really sold on. Like for a while, like for a few years maybe, all I could see everywhere is like how personas will solve every problem for you as a designer. But it always felt like something was not quite right with personas. I wasn't really sold on it. I'm actually right now reading a book called Competing Against Luck, written by Professor Clayton Christensen, who's famous for having created the theory of disruptive innovations in Harvard Business School. And he talks about how the concept of focusing on people's attributes doesn't help you solve problems because he brings up examples of how the same person could have multiple problems and would not fit any particular personas. Like you could be one persona in one use case and another persona in a different case, like so to speak, almost, because you're using this product in different cases. And what he came up with is something like a framework that also focuses on the problem rather than the particular attributes of the people. And he called that the jobs to be done framework, which is a really, really interesting framework. I haven't like discussed this with anyone at the company at AJN Smart yet, but I really think there is something here in the way that like the vocabulary that this framework gives you in order to frame problems that I think could be very beneficial for all designers to take a look at. And we actually have a meeting tomorrow. Like this is not relevant for people, but we actually have a meeting tomorrow for how we can improve the sprint. And this was something that I was going to bring up as nice. Something that we can use to improve the way that we understand a problem before we go into a design sprint. People are interested, if people are interested, definitely check out the book called Competing Against Luck. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and just Jobs to be Done as a framework. Have you heard of this, Jobs to be Done, Tim?
Yes, I have heard about it, but I'm not familiar with it at all. I mean, I have encountered it a couple of times. It sounded really interesting, but I have never really used the framework myself. So that's why I'm also super excited about tomorrow. I actually just had, this is also completely irrelevant for the listeners, but I just had a
that's
conversation.
That's what the podcast is about.
Yeah, exactly. It's just us talking about our meetings.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is interesting.
Basecamp is actually a huge fan of the Jobs to be Done framework. When I was Googling it, I saw results for Basecamp talking about it. And for those of you listening who don't know, Basecamp is a project management tool that we use at AJN Smart. And we're just huge fans of their product. And their founders were Jason Fried and DHH. If you don't know their work, you should check out their book called Rework and just follow them on Twitter. Maybe follow Jason Fried. DHH is not the happiest person to follow. He's
great. I love him. He's kind of, so angry about it.
He's a little grumpy.
No, I think they're both great.
Yeah. So yeah, they said that they've employed this framework to great advantage, and it helped them really understand how they should think about prioritizing features to work on. So this is also something interesting to look at. You can find a few talks of them on YouTube, and there are a few podcasts as well, where Ryan Singer from Basecamp talks about their use of the Jobs to be Done framework. All right, I think that's enough with that topic. We've been talking like for like half an hour about this. I thought we would be talking more like 15 minutes or something. All right, the next topic that I wanted to discuss with you, Tim, is an article. It's another article by a designer and developer called Andy Matushak. And this is quite a brilliant software engineer who used to work at Apple and then Khan Academy. He worked at Apple as part of the UI kit team. So he actually built parts of iOS, and he built the UI frameworks that every developer uses when they're working on an iOS app. I really get jealous of these people because they're just good at everything. So there's Mike Mattis as well, a famous developer who was also at Apple, worked on the UI kit team as well, and then went on to work at Facebook on the Paper app. So the thing that I like about these guys is that they really bring the best of both worlds when it comes to building products, because they have the engineering side and the design side, and they bring it together to make something that's really unique. I mean, maybe this kind of touches on the age-old argument of should designers code and what that should mean that we're not going to go into today. But I just think that whenever I see someone who's good at both, I usually pay attention, because those guys or girls can really bring a perspective that is unique. And so this guy, Andy Matushak, is talking about books in this case. His article is called Why Books Don't Work. And this is kind of a fuzzier design topic, because it's not about a particular product per se. It's about education and the transmission of knowledge. So like I said, Andy Matushak worked for a while in Khan Academy, which is a huge online platform for learning. And there he was doing some experiments and research on what is the best way to help people learn a concept and transfer knowledge. And in this article, he discusses the design of books like as a medium and why they don't work. So he talks about two things in this article. It's a very long read, but it's very, very interesting. I'm going to put it in the show notes, and it's a highly recommended read. And he breaks it down into lectures and books. And he says, if you've ever sat down in a lecture in your life, you know that a lecture is not the best way to learn something. There is research to show that people just lose attention after a few minutes of going into the lecture. And both lectures and books are built on this underlying assumption that is not actually validated by research, that all you need to do to transfer information from one person to another is to just say it, and the person receives it, and that's how the information is transferred. And this has a name. Apparently, it's called transmissionism, and it's been disproven by lots of research as a good way, as an optimal way to transfer knowledge. It does work, obviously, in some cases, but it's not at all the optimal way to transfer knowledge from one person to another. And I just found this article so fascinating because it actually tied in research about learning and took it and transformed it into a design problem. So in the past, I mean, I'm currently a master's student, so I haven't finished my thesis yet, but I didn't used to have a lot of respect for the research design community because I felt they were just off in their own world doing their own thing. And whatever happens there doesn't really get to the market and doesn't impact anything. And so if that's the case, then what's the point of it all? Why is everyone just going and working there in that corner? But what Andy Matushak did here is he talks about what the research is doing when it comes to learning, then taking that and transforming it into a design problem and basing his hypotheses as to what a solution might be on research. And this really gave me a whole new perspective on the role of research in design, like, and where designers could find opportunities for new products. So if you're a designer and you come up with a new idea for a product, you could just go and, like, on a hunch and try to design something. But actually, a really also great resource for finding ideas that have already been validated is to actually look at research and see, like, that's where the designer comes in, because research articles are going to be, like, very technical. They're going to be hard to get through. They're not just going to reach the market on their own. But a designer can actually look at a few. If you get interested in a topic, you can go read about it and then find out what the, you know, state-of-the-art research is saying about it and take that and then formulate kind of a hypothesis for which type of product would solve this. But you're not starting from a random place. You're actually starting from a pretty good place of research, which will give you, like, a higher chance of actually succeeding once you design something. And it obviously is going to take trial and error and experimentation and all of that. But I just found it very, very fascinating. And I've been talking nonstop for a few minutes, so I'm going to pause to see.
Yeah, that was like the longest sentence I've
I really, if you have any thoughts on this, Tim.
Yeah, I find that interesting. I mean, it's something I noticed with myself that whenever we prepare for a new client, we're always doing these kind of like research deep dives, just trying to learn as much as possible about the subject matter. And actually, this is one of the things that I enjoy most, I think, in my day-to-day work as a designer. Just this kind of like exploration of a space and trying to learn as much as possible about it in a very short amount of time. So you also have to be highly selective about what you learn. I mean, usually it's not about understanding every little detail, but you have to get almost like a high-level understanding of the problem space. And that's actually something you can do in a pretty short amount of time. Doesn't mean that you will be able to hold a lecture on it, of course. I mean, but it allows you to ask intelligent questions to your client, because the client usually understands these things down to the deepest detail. But it's very hard to actually find a common ground if you don't even know what questions you want to ask them. And to understand what the most intelligent and most impactful questions actually are to get answers on, you need to have this overview. And this is something I enjoy greatly. I mean, I think in all my favorite sprints we did with clients, I have learned a lot about things like physiology, how, for example, I don't know, human sleep works, or how the metabolism works when you are fasting or things like that. I mean, there are so many interesting things you can learn even when you're doing like more down-to-earth B2B projects. It's so interesting to learn about specific industries. I mean, we have been on a sprint earlier this year where we learned everything imaginable about the packaging industry, which turned out to be an extremely interesting topic. I mean, I had no idea. And the cool thing is, once you have like this overview of just like, you almost like only know the cornerstones of a specific area you want to explore, but immediately you are able to kind of like click new bits of information into it. And it's almost like you're filling out this puzzle. But as you know, when you're trying to solve a puzzle, it's usually better to start with the edges, because then it gets a lot easier to like fill in the blanks and find the right pieces and where they have to go. Whereas if you just like look at, I don't know, you take like five puzzle pieces and you try to understand them in the greatest detail, and you might not be able to click them together. Maybe you are, if you have done the puzzle like a million, actually the puzzle analogy is really stupid. It's not really getting me that far. But anyway, I'm just rambling now. What I want to say is, I'm basically agreeing with everything you just said. But this article, I mean, I should mention that I haven't read the article myself yet. I mean, I have heard about the article and I heard it got really, really interesting feedback. What, like, how would you sum up the article if somebody asked you, so what's the issue with books? Like, I've never heard anyone say that books don't work. What's the problem with books? I'm reading books every day.
Yeah. So
what is it saying?
So he says, of course, that books are definitely, you know, they hold a ton of knowledge and a lot of people learn from them. But it's just that they are so inefficient in transmitting knowledge that you have to put in a lot of work and you don't take a lot from it at the end. So he says, picture some serious nonfiction tomes like The Selfish Gene, Thinking Fast and Slow, Guns, Germs and Steel, etc., and books like that. He says, have you ever had a book like this when you've read, come up in a conversation only to discover that you'd absorbed what amounts to a few sentences? So he's talking about the idea that you can read a book and enjoy it very much, and that's great. That's time well spent if you enjoyed it. But at the end of the day, when it comes time to talk about it, you either find out that you actually haven't actually understood everything that the book is trying to say, or you don't actually remember it for like various reasons.
So that's interesting, because one thing I notice when I'm reading nonfiction, and it's actually something that annoys me greatly, is when the author is kind of like repeating the same point over and over again. And after the fifth time, you're like, I get it now. Okay, I get it. Like, do you have anything else to say? Or like, should I just like stop here? I mean, usually I just keep on reading. I'm not great at like just like stop reading a book when I feel like it's not getting anywhere. But maybe that's one of the reasons why it's so inefficient, because you kind of like have to repeat the same point over and over again sometimes. I mean, you could also cynically say that they just need to kind of like get to the length of like an actual publishable book sometimes. But
yeah,
in my experience, I mean, sometimes repeating the point can make sense. I mean, in a way, it's almost like the same way how you learn the alphabet, for example, in elementary school. Like, it's not like this exploratory process necessarily. Like, I remember I just had to repeat the same simple words over and over and over. And then after some time, it becomes second nature and you don't even think about it anymore. But it's interesting that this doesn't necessarily happen when you're reading a book, and it's almost like you get a few bullet points out of it. Maybe you get like 20% of the actual points that are conveyed in the book and you actually remember them. Another thing I noticed as well is that sometimes when I read a book again after years and years, and maybe I've really enjoyed it the first time, and we're talking nonfiction here, so we're not talking about like literature or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's nonfiction. And I remember, oh, that was a great book. I should read it again. And then you read it again. And then suddenly I find completely new meaning in it. It's almost like I'm reading the book for the first time. And it's different because I'm now reading it with all the experiences that I have myself amassed over the time since I first read it. And now I'm almost like unlocking knowledge inside the book that just didn't connect with me at all. And sometimes I think the most interesting and insightful books are actually the ones that just kind of like confirm something that I only subconsciously felt. Like, it's almost like I don't really know how to put it into words. I just have this thing that seems to, you know, it's somehow bothering me. And then you're reading a book and then the author manages to kind of like break it down into something where you're just saying, that's exactly it. And it's very rare for me that I'm reading a book and I am feeling like I'm actually processing something completely new. Like, it's something I've never heard about before. Usually I'm already having some kind of like context that I can almost like click the book into, and suddenly it's like the puzzle analogy I had earlier that didn't go anywhere. Yeah.
We come back to so the puzzle. You want to make it work somehow.
Yeah. But it's really like the missing, like the book is providing a missing piece of the puzzle. And now you finally understand how everything is connected. I have to agree that it's maybe not the most efficient way of conveying information, because I mean, we're talking about a span of months and sometimes years, right? Where I am just by accident, almost like reading a book again. And then I'm getting this tremendous value out of it. But I'm wondering if there's like a better way of doing it, which would also be extremely valuable for, you know, education, schools. I mean, the education system is a mess, for example. Like, it would be fantastic if something better came along. And it's interesting that we're still stuck with books in a way, because it's such an old medium.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Thousands of years old, literally.
Yeah.
And yeah, to your point about just reading a book that actually articulates what you were already thinking, I believe this is really one of the best outcomes that could happen of you reading a book, is a book can give you language for thoughts that you already had, but you didn't have the language to express. Just like my example earlier about personas, when I'm reading this book, I'm like agreeing very much with it. And it's putting, like making the arguments for why you shouldn't actually focus on personas and focus on the problem much better than I could have done otherwise. And now I have all of these terms from the Jobs to be Done framework to express why that is the case and why I think this is a better approach. So I totally believe that a book giving you language and vocabulary to express ideas is one of the best things that you can take out of a book. This used to like frustrate me in the past whenever I read a book, to feel like, oh, okay, great. Now the author is going to make up a bunch of new terms just to make it him or herself sound smart. While like that might be true sometimes, but in a lot of cases, it's actually good when the author gives some concepts like a specific term, because now we can use this as shorthand for our understanding of a particular concept.
It's interesting to think about the history of books as well, and how we started off with parchment scrolls or something, and then it turned into, like actual books printed on paper. And now we still have books, but we also have like completely new ways of experiencing content. And I mean, something that I noticed when I'm reading nonfiction is that I'm almost creating a mind map. I mean, I'm not doing it consciously. It's almost, I'm just taking a stack of sticky notes, writing some, you know, bullet points on it. And then in the end, I just put it in front of me and I kind of like rearrange things. And then I start seeing patterns. And in a way, it is a mind map. It's a way of rearranging informations and contextualizing it in a different way. Yeah, it's fascinating to think about
exactly
how different you can process information as well.
Yeah, and the author, Andy Matushak, says that, so I'm just going to read a paragraph here. He says, I acknowledge earlier that, of course, some people do absorb knowledge from books. Those are people who really think about what they're reading. So he actually brings up the topic of lectures before, because he says that a lot of professors would argue that you don't actually learn in the lecture, but the lecture just gives you the raw information that you need to start the learning process later on. And the learning happens only when you start doing exercises, when you start to play around with the ideas and do like your own work on it. You don't learn just by listening to the professor. And that's what a lot of professors argue. And the same thing with books. So he says here, indeed, those people who really do think about what they're reading. So the book here also serves as just an introduction to the learning process. Reading alone will not transfer that knowledge to you. The process starts by you reading, but you only start to learn when your brain goes on and starts to think like, this idea reminds me of dot, dot, dot. It reminds you of something else. So now you're doing this connection in your brain and building that mind map that you just mentioned. Or you say like, oh, this point conflicts with something I read somewhere else. Maybe I need to go and cross-reference that and compare them. Or, you know, you take some notes, you transcribe. Basically, you're synthesizing the knowledge here. And he says these skills don't come easily to people and you have to be very deliberate about it. apparently, like in research, these are called metacognition skills. So like thinking about thinking and how you're actually learning. So you need to, if you really want to learn from a book, you need to be taking your own notes, making your own summaries. That's why it never really makes sense for you to read someone else's summary of something. You need to do the work of summarizing a book for the ideas to sink in into your own brain. And so he says, books don't take that into account. And I'm just going to start wrapping this up. So what he did here is he made an example. He says he doesn't know what the solution could be like, but there are pieces of research that hint at better ways of transferring knowledge. So actually, textbooks come closer than normal books, like, you know, a school or university textbooks, because they interleave, you know, lessons and exercises, but even then they don't do a great job because they just dump a lot of exercises on you and you don't know which ones you should start from and you don't know what to do when you don't know how to solve one and so on. But basically, this is still a better approach. And there's also the concept of spaced repetition. And you also touched on repetition earlier with learning the alphabet. Spaced repetition basically works instead of rote memorization and you trying to read something like three times in a row to remember it, you would actually read it, for example, let's say five times total, but in each time, like you're increasing the interval between the last time you read the material. And that's how you commit something to long-term memory. And there's been a lot of research on that. And so he designed basically a quote-unquote kind of book, but which is actually a website. He says, I don't know what the solution looks like. It could be a book. It could be not a book. It could be like a new medium, just like how, you know, Instagram stories and Snapchat stories are a medium. Books are a medium. Blogs are a medium to transfer information. And so the medium could look something very different. But he has an experimental website that talks about quantum computing. It's at quantum.country. And in it, he's basically explaining concepts of quantum computing, but he's interleaving them with small exercises that are interactive so that you can actually test your understanding of the knowledge that you just read. And like what he's trying to do here is strike a balance of how much reading should be there and how many, like how often should there be exercises, what type of exercises, and then how these exercises can help you commit these concepts to memory and reassure you that whether or not you understand the concept, if not, maybe you go up and you read the paragraph that you just read again and so on. And so like this whole discussion about like basically books in this case, I brought it up because I thought it was super interesting how this person took research and tried to solve a problem that is really big, much bigger than like most of the product problems that you see on people talking about on Medium of how, what is the opacity of the purchase button should be on this e-commerce website to get people to click. This is a much larger problem that is based on research, and it's a much harder problem, but it also makes it in a lot of ways a lot more interesting because it's that much more challenging.
That reminds me of a free online course that I did a couple of months ago called Learning How to Learn.
Oh, interesting.
Powerful Mental Tools to Help You Master Tough Subjects. It's by Dr. Barbara Oakley and Dr. Terence Sinofsky. I think they're both researchers for learning, essentially. How does the neurology of learning work? And a lot of the things from the article are actually things that also come up in the course, like spaced repetition. And it's free. It's on Coursera. I don't know if I'm allowed to plug.
Yeah, I found it. This looks
really good. It's
actually
really interesting. I really like the course because it also confirmed a couple of things that I, again, just kind of like felt deep inside, but I never really knew how to articulate. Like, for example, I mean, I don't know about you, Amr, but when I was in high school, there were these times when I didn't properly prepare for a test in advance and instead would just cram like 2 or 3 days before the test, would just like sit down like crazy hours deep until the night. And then I would actually perform really okay on the test, but of course really tired, really stressed out. And then after 2 weeks, I would not remember anything of
totally.
What came. Yeah,
it would just
and
be purged.
Exactly. And this is exactly the thing that the course is also touching on, like why that is actually a pretty ineffective approach of learning, even like based on human neurology and how there are way, way better things of taking in new information, building, you know, associations with existing knowledge and actually retaining it into long-term memory. So check out the course.
It's course will be in the show notes. And for those of you who don't know how to access the show notes in your podcast app, you can just Google Product Breakfast Club and then the number of the episode. I think this is going to be 79. And you'll find like a Medium post with all of the links in it to the stuff that we talked about, whether it's books or articles and so on. So what do you think, Tim? Should we wrap it up?
Yeah, I think it's time.
Cool.
So much new information to retain now. We shouldn't push people.
Yeah, I think people, to get the maximum value out of this podcast, they should listen to it a total of 7 times.
Yeah.
And just have that, listen to it once now and once again in a week.
Yeah.
And another in 3 weeks. Yeah. And so on.
Yeah.
So yeah, Tim, where can people find you online?
People can find me on Twitter. My handle is TimHoefer. And yeah, that's it.
Cool. And people can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at my full name, which is AmrKhalifeh, Amr Khalifa. And that will also be in the show notes for both me and Tim. We hope you guys enjoyed this one. Let us know on Twitter or Instagram, wherever. You can just email into the podcast. I don't remember what the email is, but I'll put it in the show notes. And let us know what you thought of this episode. Maybe you want us to just take over the podcast from Jake and Jonathan. So if you think that, definitely write in. If you don't think that, it's fine. You don't need to tell us. So, all right, let's sing it out.
Cool. What is the outro song? Is it
the same? It's the same.
Okay.
It's the same. All right. 1, 2, 3.
Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club with Amr and Tim.